Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we are going to gather around the virtual water cooler and talk about what we've been up to. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, and apologies to listeners. I'm getting over a cold. I may sound terrible, and I may occasionally be not fast enough to mute a cough, so I apologize.
No problem, Jacob. I hope you feel well or feel better soon anyway. I wanted to begin this episode like I began yesterday's episode by shouting out Slash Film's oral history about the final season of Battlestar Galactica. Just a really big, long piece that has brand new interviews with a bunch of people who are involved with the making of that show. So once again, if you watch that show, please check that out. A lot of work went into it. Devin Meenan wrote it. It's a great piece. Check that out. Okay, so now that we've got that out of the way, Jacob, what have you been doing recently?
I'm tempted to not talk about this because I feel like every time I talk about life goals on this podcast, I always mess it up. So I was like, I'm going to do this, and it doesn't happen. but I am preparing to run my first 10K. I've been off social media, so no one knows this, but I've been spending the past few months running. I've got into it. I've run two 5Ks. I've improved my endurance and stamina a lot. I bought a brand new pair of running shoes a few months ago, and literally the rubber on the bottom came off. The foam was coming off in chunks, so it warmed to the ground so much. So I actually went and bought several new pairs of running shoes last week, so I can actually rotate between them for different uses. I'm becoming that person. But yeah, I signed up for the Cap City 10K, which is a very popular. It's the largest 10K in Texas. The 10K is 6.2 miles through downtown Austin, a lot of uphill areas. It's going to be an absolute nightmare scenario. But I am going to make it work, and I'm going to do it. I'm going to finish. And in fact, Slash Film's Ryan Scott is also running it. So maybe we'll get him to chat about it on a future episode of the show. So, fingers crossed I can pull this off. My goal is that if I can keep this up, I want to try to go for a half marathon in January of next year. So,
nice.
We'll see. I mean, I'm down 30 pounds. I'm exercising every day, and I'm trying not to mess this one up, Ben. So I feel like my hobby, making it into a bit of a hobby, like I only listen to audiobooks when I exercise. I'm not allowed to listen to them at other points. So that's like, want to know what's going to happen next in the book, I got to go hit the gym.
Oh, that's a good idea. I was going to say, it seems a little weird. Well, I mean, I say this as somebody who listens to podcasts while I run, but like my wife and basically everybody else that I know that runs always opts to listen for music because you want that sort of like driving, you know, percussive nature or whatever to help, you know, push you forward or whatever. But yeah, I like the idea of like the audiobook as a treat or something and the reward to working out or something like that.
Yeah. And I will say that, this is something I've also been seeing a personal trainer, which has been helpful. If you can, I know it's kind of a luxury. I'm fortunate to find somebody I can afford to go to who's a employee at my local gym, also trains on the side, at a very reasonable rate. But one thing he suggested, and I've been doing it, is when I do actual races, I don't listen to music or audio. I literally just focus on running and breathing because I noticed that one thing that he trained me to focus on is steady breathing while I'm running. And I remember when I first started, I would get out of breath really, really fast, like just completely gasping like a few minutes into a run. But if you really sort of focus on your breathing and breathe in a very controlled method and like really fill your lungs and really make that like your number one key thing, even above your feet, like be more mindful of the lungs and the feet, then you can actually go a lot further and endure a lot more. So on actual races, I have been going without music and just putting all of my mental energy into monitoring my breathing. It's been very helpful. So I train with audio in my ears, but when it comes time to actual events, no audio whatsoever.
Awesome. Okay, cool. Let's see. I guess that's all we've been doing recently. I haven't really been doing much. Let's get into what we've been reading. What have you been reading recently?
I've read quite a few things. I started with the new book, kind of a bad title, Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions by Edward Zwick, the filmmaker. Have you heard of this book, Ben?
Trying to think. Oh, yes. Actually, I remember Edward Zwick. He's the director of movies like Glory and Last Samurai. I remember he was sort of making the rounds recently because this is a new book, right?
Yeah, it just came out a month or two ago.
Yeah. I think I saw an interview or something where he was talking about it. It's like a collection of stories from, you know, his years directing movies and stuff, basically.
Yeah, in the first chapter, he says that he wanted to write essentially the next generation version of Adventures in the Screen Trade, the legendary book by William Goldman, a screenwriter from the 70s. And I'd say this is comparable in terms of tone. He's very, very, the candor is there. He's very honest. Some of his collaborators come off like Denzel Washington comes off extremely well in this book. Like you like walk away from the book going, wow, what an interesting dude. Others are a bit more complicated. Like this chapter about Legends of the Fall working with Brad Pitt is interesting. And those two did not get along. The Tom Cruise stuff is wild, extremely entertaining. Matthew Broderick stuff is like, oof. The Julia Roberts stuff is oof. He's very, so if you want some good celebrity gossip about the actors he's worked with, he's very honest about that and about many other collaborators. Because he was the first director on Shakespeare in Love before it was almost ripped away from him. He still was on it as a producer and won the Best Picture Oscar for it. But his chapter about Harvey Weinstein is definitely not going to have any surprises for you in terms of how crappy he was to Edward Zwick. It's a lot of really good stories. And Edward Zwick, I don't think he's made that many great movies, but he's made a lot of good movies and a lot of middling movies and even a few like outright stinkers. So for him to be like really candid about, you know, the process of being a working Hollywood filmmaker, both in film and TV, because he also did, you know, shows like 30 Something and My So-Called Life. And just to sort of like, I read this shortly after I finished the Stanley Kubrick biography I talked about on a previous episode of this show. And that, book was so focused on, you know, a guy who's seen as a singular genius. Edward Zwick, I don't think anybody's gonna call him a genius on a Kubrick level. So, but like, doesn't mean there's any less hard work going on. It doesn't mean the struggle isn't there. It doesn't mean there's any less artistry that goes into the work he tried to do and still does. So it's really valuable to have like somebody who's a B+ filmmaker writing about his experience in Hollywood. And I say B+ with affection. I don't mean to like drag him down, because he's a really entertaining writer and the book's really good. And I just found it to be very valuable to like understand the mindset of somebody who's working in the grind. Like, it isn't like a filmmaker who can sit on his laurels and wait for the next grand project to come to him. He's a guy who had to get out there and get the job done, and still does. So I appreciate his perspective, and I found the book to be very funny and very interesting and full of great anecdotes. Like the Tom Cruise stuff is like you see all the Tom Cruise stories from the Mission Impossible sets, but him just being a total madman, like a joyous madman. And Edward Zwick kind of backs it up in his stories about working with him. I'll share one story that from the book, give you an idea of the kind of stuff he shares. But he clashed hard enough with Brad Pitt on Legend of the Fall that they were essentially in daily screaming matches, throwing things at each other, barely avoiding fist fights. And at the very, very end of the process, he was asked to record an audio commentary for the home video release. And he said he would only do it if Brad Pitt did it with him. So they went to dinner, buried the hatchet, smoked a giant joint, and did the entire Legends of the Fall audio commentary completely stoned. They said you can hear them being stoned on the audio commentary. They're both giggling a lot, and that's why. And then they shook hands and never spoke ever again. So that's wow. the kind of stories you get like in every chapter of this book. So I really recommend Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions if you want really good, nitty-gritty, you know, gossipy, but also like really wise stories from a guy who's actually been through the grinder.
Okay, yeah, and that is by Edward Zwick, Z-W-I-C-K, if you're looking to spell that last name. What else have you been reading, Jacob?
I read two books by Victor LaValle. The first one is actually a novella, to be specific. It's called The Ballad of Black Tom. And Victor LaValle is a fantasy and horror writer. And the Ballad of Black Tom specifically is his riff on cosmic horror and Lovecraft. I mean, it's no secret that Lovecraft, H.P. Lovecraft, the famed and influential, you know, horror sci-fi writer from the 20s and 30s, was a racist. And even his best stories have elements of racism in the margins, and his worst stories have racism front and center in pretty profound ways. And the most infamous of his stories is a book called, or a short story called, called The Horror at Red Hook, where the big twist is, all the immigrants are evil. So it's a really, really nasty piece of work. And scholars of Lovecraft, even those who are kind of willing to say, yeah, other stories have elements of racism, but they're still worth reading, this is the one where everybody kind of says, no, thank you. So mm-hmm. Victor LaVale, being a black man, decided to rewrite The Horror at Red Hook from the POV of the minority characters in the story, specifically a character who becomes nicknamed Black Tom in the story, who is a early 20s musician and street hustler, essentially, sort of a con man and just a vagabond who sort of just makes quick bucks on the streets of Harlem in the 20s.
Hmm.
And he gets wrapped up in an occult mystery. And you sort of see the Horror Red Hook story told from the POV of him as this sort of cosmic horror conspiracy starts to take form, or with him in the center of it. And it's really scary and really good. And I think there's a lot of people try to do the Lovecraft pastiche these days where they say like, oh, there's a tentacled monster or there's an elder god. But they kind of miss why people are still interested in Lovecraft writing, you know, 100 years later, despite the racism, despite the problematic elements, which that he was really good at structure and tone, and the way he would shift POV or not say things and say certain things. And Victor LaVale really leans into that structure. This feels like a really classical cosmic horror story that fits into the tone and style of those classic stories while feeling thoroughly modern in its POV. And I guess the very, very Jordan Peele element of this, for lack of a more direct comparison, is that in this kind of cosmic horror, traditionally, the idea is that humankind, you know, can't see the full truth, because if they saw what the universe actually was, they saw, you know, the monsters at the edge of the universe, things like that govern us, we would all go insane. So we knowingly don't look beyond our own little circle so we can stay sane. And what this book does that's so fascinating is that it takes that basic gist and applies it to race in America, saying that white people, even like well-meaning white people, put on blinders, ignore racism, because to fully understand the pain people are going through would change the way they fundamentally live their lives. Mm-hmm. So it manages to use cosmic horror to like really explore, you know, actual subjects like race. And it's a really smart update. And the idea that it's using that message through a prism of a famously racist story to sort of like redeem, not necessarily redeem, but take control of that story and make mm-hmm. it something new is really, really interesting. It's also a fast read. It's like 200 pages. It's a novella. You can knock it down in a few hours.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So that's The Ballad of Black Tom. What about The Changeling?
The Changeling, I once I finished The Ballad of Black Tom, I immediately started reading The Changeling. This is one of his more recent books. It's not his most recent, but like maybe 2018. And it was adapted last year into an Apple TV Plus series, which I feel like kind of came and went, starring Lakeith Stanfield. I describe it as low fantasy. You know, it's not like, you know, it's not high fantasy like, you know, Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones. It's set in modern day New York City. It follows a father, played by Lakeith Stanfield in the show, who undergoes a very serious family tragedy. And I don't want to say much more than that, but then he finds himself sort of drawn into a fantasy world to try to redeem himself and save his family. And like I said, I imagine the show would probably front load that detail, but it's kind of buried deeper into the book, which is why I'm trying to dance around it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about 90%, you know, family drama and about 10%, you know, fantasy. So it's very much has this thread of magical realism running through it, as opposed to being an up and out fantasy adventure. It's really good. And reading it, it's such a book. Like the way it's structured, the way it's laid out, the way information is relayed, it is such a book that I can kind of see it being adapted into a movie. I have no idea how it's a TV show. Like, I do not understand how this material becomes an 8-episode series without like ruining what makes it special. And I'll check it out, I think. Maybe in time for the next water cooler, I'll watch some of it. But it really feels like a victim of the modern day streaming idea of, well, we have this property, can we make it 8 episodes as opposed to like what's the right way to adapt this?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll check it out and hope you're proven wrong. But The Changeling is really good. It's very dark. Like I especially think if you're a parent, if the material in it maybe a bit tough to take. But if you're a fan of Neil Gaiman, if you're a fan of, you know, of modern fantasy, urban fantasy, The Changeling is extremely good. And you know, I do recommend, I do say, if you haven't, you know, don't know much more beyond what I've said, or if you haven't looked at the Apple TV Plus series at all, go in a little bit blind if it sounds interesting to you, because I went in knowing, not knowing much about it, and I was really refreshed by how the story unfolds.
Okay, cool. So that's The Changeling by Victor Lavalle. Okay, last thing that you've been reading, another Reacher book?
No, actually, this is interesting. I'm taking a Reacher break because I reached book 22, which was originally going to be the author Lee Child's last Reacher book. He wanted to write 22 books, then stop, was his original plan. And it kept on going. And the Reacher fan base generally agrees that the books immediately following his 22nd book are either okay or bad. And then he hands the reins the series over to his brother, who's currently writing them. And the opinion on those is that they're either okay or bad. So after really enjoying the first 22 Reacher books, and also knowing that Dick Hill, who read most of those books for audiobook, who knows how I've been listening to them, he stepped away from the series after reading that book. I thought, okay, this is a good time for me to take a Reacher break. The last book that everybody agrees is good, the last one read by Dick Hill, who's the best audiobook narrator I've ever listened to. So I'll revisit the rest of the series later on. But I thought this is a good time to listen to, no audiobook version, this is a physical book for Reacher Said Nothing by Andy Martin. Reacher Said Nothing is it's a really hard book to describe, but essentially Andy Martin is a literary scholar and journalist and a big fan of Lee Child and Jack Reacher books. So he interviewed Lee Child a number of times, and one day emailed him and said, I have a crazy idea. What if I sat in your office with you as you started writing the next Reacher book and watched you write it and wrote a book about you writing the book? And Lee Child said yes. And The Reacher Said Nothing is a book about Andy Martin shadowing Lee Child over a year as he promotes his new book while starting his new book and while trying to make deadline on this book. He'll like literally be over his shoulder watching him type, and Lee Child will hand him pages and he'll read them. And you see the process of how like an airport, you know, beach novel is written in real time. Because these are authors, you know, who write a book a year. They're on a contract, you know, to turn in 100,000 words in 8 months to make sure they hit, you know, publishing deadlines. How does that happen? And the answer, and I did not know. And reading this book gives you an insight into how that happens. And specifically, it's about the writing of the book Make Me, which is the 19th Reacher book, 18th, something around there. It's a really good one with some really good twists, and seeing the book come together after having read the novel makes it a really satisfying read. Like, it's probably not a book you should read if you haven't read Make Me, but if you have read Make Me or want to read that one first and then this, seeing how the book was written and what changed or what was in place in the beginning is really, really fascinating. Famously, Lee Child was a TV writer and producer for British TV before he became a novelist. And there was a show he used to produce, and there's a chapter talking about this in the book, where it essentially sounds like the American TV series Chopped, where there were two refrigerators, and each fridge would have, like, random ingredients, like, you know, pancake mix, strawberries, and white wine. And you have to make a dish out of it, you know, and a time limit, and judges would, you know, judge it. And he compares his writing process to that TV show because Lee Child doesn't plan. He does not outline. He starts writing, starts introducing elements, and then tries to see how those elements form into a mystery as he goes.
Oh, wow.
So he compares his own writing to like a reality TV show competition, which was really interesting. That's the kind of nugget that if that sounded interesting to you, then this book is pretty much that for 250 pages. So that's called Reacher Said Nothing by Andy Martin.
That's really cool. It sounds like, I know there have obviously been a ton of behind the scenes making of books, but this one, the way that you're describing it, it sounds more like a making of documentary or like a featurette or something on a Blu-ray than, you know, a typical sort of like 30,000 foot, you know, arm's length. I'm observing this with, you know, through hindsight or anything like that kind of experience. So
yeah, there's even a point in the book where the publisher pretty much tells Lee Child that he can no longer participate in this book, and Lee Child blows him off and keeps on doing it anyway.
Amazing. Okay, well, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. All right, so let's get into what we've been watching, Jacob. I watched a movie called Snack Shack, which is a very small movie. It was in theaters. It even made its way to the small AMC that is near me. Well, it came out on March 15th and is already out of theaters. But I imagine this is one of those movies that's going to go to VOD like very, very quickly if it's not already there. And the premise of this movie is it's a coming of age film set in 1991. And it's about these two guys who like kind of a lease comes up on a snack shack at their local pool. And they bid for the opportunity to be the people who get to run it for the summer. And they get to like keep the money that they make while they run this thing. So it's basically like a Superbad-esque kind of comedy where like a girl comes between them and like, you know, the two guys are about to graduate high school and go off to different colleges. And like one of them isn't prepared for that. And the other one is a little bit more ambitious. And like, you know, their friendship hangs in the balance and they haven't really spoken about their plans beyond high school yet. And it's like they're hanging on to the last days of childhood kind of thing. So it's really like a movie that you've seen a million times before. I was personally interested in this because I did work at effectively a snack shack at a local pool when I was, I think it was in the summers, like when I would come back home from college. And maybe like my senior year of high school as well. I don't really remember the dates now. So I just wanted to see if it captured that sort of milieu really well. And I would say that it does. As somebody who has had this experience, basically, I would say that it does a pretty good job. Obviously there's much more like, I think this story takes place in Nebraska, I think. But anyway, there's a lot of like smoking and drinking and like underage sex and all these things that I personally didn't do when I was younger or in high school. And every time I see that in any movie, I'm always like, man, was I just like in an area of the country where this was just not really the vibe? Or is this only a movie thing where, you know, like every time high schoolers get together, there's just like constantly beer and drugs everywhere.
I wanted this too, but I think you and I were just extremely well-behaved little nerds.
That's probably true, honestly. The most depressing answer there. But yeah, I would say like if you're in the mood for like a nice kind of like summery type of movie that isn't going to change and deviate from the tropes in any way at all, check out Snack Shack. Otherwise, it just kind of feels like maybe a little too derivative, a little too familiar. You've seen this type of thing a million times before. It has a couple of like okay aspects to it. Gabriel LaBelle, who played the kid in The Fablemans, is one of the main kids here and just seems like totally unrecognizable to me. I didn't realize that until after the movie was over. And I was like, holy shit, that was him, because he's totally different as a character in this movie. So that's nice. And then Nick Robinson plays a supporting role in this. He plays like the sort of like college age or maybe slightly older kid who is like the guy who like these high schoolers look up to. And I just thought it was like a nice part for Nick Robinson because he starred in a movie called The Kings of Summer back in like 2013, where he was effectively playing like the younger version of these kids. So he's like graduated into sort of like cooler, older guy role a little bit. And I thought he was fun to watch in this. So that is Snack Shack. It's not available at my local theater anymore. It may be at yours, depending on how big your theater scene is around you. But check it out if you're in the mood for that. If you're not in the mood for like that specific thing, but if you're in the mood for like something that sounds like that and that I would say is a better movie, I would check out The Way, Way Back, which also I want to say is from 2013. Have you ever seen that one, Jacob? Do you know that movie I'm talking about?
I remember the trailer, but I never actually saw it.
Oh man, it's so good. It has a really, really good cast. I want to say Toni Collette is like the mom. Steve Carell is in there. But Sam Rockwell is like the leader of the, he's like the main employee at this pool where this kid gets a summer job. And it's just like pure good vibes, summer stuff, like high, you know, that kind of yeah, that, that kind of vibe is definitely something that you want to check out if you're into that. It's called The Way, Way Back. Okay. I also watched Cinema Paradiso for the first time. Have you ever seen this movie, Jacob?
No, this is on my list of shame. I know it. I need to watch it. It's everybody's favorite movie. Makes them cry all the time, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. I don't remember. I think I did actually cry at the very end of this movie. It's very emotional. Really, really solid. The most interesting thing to me about this movie, though, is this is one of those cases where basically like studio notes or like meddling with the edit resulted in what I would say is a much better movie, because I didn't learn this until after I watched it and I was sort of reading about the movie. Evidently, there are multiple cuts of this, and I watched, I think, the theatrical cut. I watched whatever's on Amazon Prime Video right now. And I found out afterwards that there's basically like an extended version of this movie that makes some decisions that I find totally baffling. And it's one of those instances where, you know, I'm my default setting, Jacob, is kind of like, I want to see what the filmmaker intended. I want to see the filmmaker's version of the thing that they wanted to make. I want to, you know, honor their sort of directorial intent as a storyteller. But this is one of those rare instances where I think it actually makes more sense and like a better overall experience to see the version that was cut up a little bit. So I'm not going to go into those details exactly what happens, but because I don't want to spoil anything for people who haven't seen this yet. But yeah, check it out. Cinema Paradiso is the movie. It's Italian, came out in 1988. It's really, really, there's like some lovely, you know, grand cinema, like old school movie palace vibes going on, plus like some nice Italian countryside type of stuff too. So I would say it's like one of the most famous international movies of the past 40 years or something. So check that out if you're interested in that at all. I also rewatched There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men for the first time in a long time. And these movies are just like so paired in my mind because of how they were seemingly jostling for Best Picture back in, what was that? I guess 2006 is when they came out, and or 2007. And
so 2007 the 2000, was the release year.
Yeah, so the 2008 Oscars.
2007 is one of those great years. Yeah, I also cannot think of one movie without thinking of the other. Like, I just instinctively think of them. And also, like, famously, I mean, the famous story is that they were filming close enough that they would see smoke from their sets. Like, the explosions on There Will Be Blood were visible to the crew of No Country for Old Men. They were filming, they say, in the same areas. These movies are linked, like, in ways that go beyond just an Oscar season. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's so fascinating to watch them both because they have that geographical connection, but they feel so different from each other. But also there's a lot of like thematic similarities going on at the same time. And it's obviously like two master filmmakers just kind of like operating at the top of their game. And there's the thing about No Country for Old Men that I was captivated by this time was just like the Josh Brolin of it all. I remember he was kind of in like a down period in his career before he got cast in that role. And he's so good in that movie. Obviously, Javier Bardem is incredible as Anton Chigurh. That was, I want to say, the first big role that I had seen him in. He went on to be in a bunch of things after that, Vicky Cristina Barcelona, and obviously like Spectre and things like that too. But like, I think this was my introduction to him as a force in the world of cinema, and he just leaves such an incredible mark. And then There Will Be Blood, it has like one of the most legendary performances of all time by Daniel Day-Lewis. And then watching it this time, I was blown away all over again by how great he is and how sort of like totemic and powerful he is in this movie, especially in the final scene, which is just like in the bowling alley is like one of the biggest like showcase moments for an actor that I can remember. And it really is like all-timer stuff. And then, but Paul Dano in that movie too is so incredible. And it's just wild to think about like how I think he had 4 days where he was only supposed to play one of the Sunday brothers in this movie originally, but somebody else was cast as the main sort of antagonist to Daniel Day-Lewis's character. And then they shot for like 2 weeks or something. And then Paul Thomas Anderson was like, you know what? This isn't working. Paul Dano, can you get in here and play this role? And he gave him, I want to say it was like he told him on a Thursday, and then by Monday or something, he had to be like ready and you know, going head to head against one of the greatest actors of all time. And he really does hold his own. He's unbelievable in this movie. And just watching the two of them go back and forth and really like bite at each other without actually saying things. And there's so much unspoken in the looks between them and everything. Just a great power play movie. Yeah, just two unreal classics, you know, that are, yeah, like you said, sort of linked geographically as well as like emotionally or something. So I don't know if you've seen those movies recently or if you have any thoughts on either one of those.
I've seen There'll Be Blood Again more recently than No Country, but they're both great movies. And man, like, I don't even know if I could pick a favorite between them. I saw them both multiple times in theaters, and they're just, I don't know, I feel like they're from a lifetime ago.
Because
they were both successes. You know, they weren't like massive box office hits, but they were hits. And I don't know, I just feel like in an ideal world, this is what we should be shooting for movies, like movies of this level of quality, care, and complexity. I think they're both very special movies. And the fact that, you know, only one could have been a Best Picture winner is really depressing to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild to think that like they predate the MCU as a whole, you know, both of these movies. And it's just, yeah, how much the landscape has shifted since then, that like studios actually made these movies. And it just feels like that would never happen today. So anyway, in some ways it's kind of like the end of an era, but I would highly recommend revisiting, or if you've never seen these movies, definitely check them out. There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men. They're both streaming right now. Finally, I saw a movie that is not streaming. It is called The Ipcress File. This is from 1965. Have you ever seen this, Jacob, by any chance?
No, I actually don't think I've ever even heard of this movie.
Okay, so Michael Caine stars in this movie, and it's a spy film basically by a lot of the people who made the James Bond, the early James Bond movies. So Sidney J. Fury is the director. He did not have anything to do with the Bond films. But Harry Saltzman is the producer. John Barry did the music. And then Peter R. Hunt is the editor. And he edited several of the Bond films and went on to direct On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And it's basically Michael Caine doing his kind of Bond thing, but it's really like an anti-Bond movie. So there's no gadgets. There's no real, you know, the sense of humor that Bond has, that the sort of like quippiness, none of that is there. Like the one-liners and stuff, there's not really any of that. It's much more of a, like, almost like a paranoid thriller, kind of like a, you know, the type of thing that you would think of when you think of like the Parallax View or like those paranoia thrillers from the 70s, right? That's kind of what this movie turns into. It starts out as like a pretty simple spy story, like espionage story about a missing scientist and the agents who have to track him down. But then it turns into, yeah, one of these sort of like paranoia thrillers. And it came out in 1965. So like, what is that, two or 3 years after the first James Bond movie? So it's really wild just to see, like, it would be as if, you know, Kevin Feige made a separate superhero movie that is like in conversation with the MCU stuff right after Thor or something. You know, it's like just really fascinating to think about from like an industry perspective, like a business perspective. And then also the movie itself is like pretty good. I mean, it's a little slow at times, but I the cinematography is incredible. There, Otto Heller is the shooter on this, and so many of the images are like through like obscured in some way, or like shot through veils, or like just really, really interesting shot selections. The type that you certainly don't see now, but it just feels unique even, you know, among all the stuff that I've seen from the 60s and 70s. So yeah, I would say this movie has been on my list of things to see for like 15 plus years. It was in my Netflix DVD library for a long time. And then it's just, as far as I can tell, it's never been streaming anywhere. And you can buy it on DVD or something like that if you can find a disc. Even that was really tough to come by about 10 years ago, because I tried to find it then and couldn't find it for like less than $100 anywhere. But now I think you can probably get it for 15 or 20 bucks or something if you want to buy a disc. But yeah, it was just, it played on AMC, and I still subscribe to cable. So this is like one of the rare times that actually came through as a benefit. So if anybody is out there and still is paying for cable and has AMC, I would recommend just scrolling through there and, oh, I'm sorry. It wasn't AMC. It was Turner Classic Movies. It was TCM.
You did get a time when AMC used to show classic movies.
Yes, I am. Yeah. Turner Classic Movies. I apologize. So yes, I would say if you're a cable subscriber, who cares about movies, just flip through there because sometimes there's stuff on there that, that is like really tough to find. And in this case, it's just not streaming anywhere. So, it's definitely worth taking that and, you know, taking a look and seeing what you might be able to stumble across. So anyway, the movie is called The Ipcress File. Michael Caine, really interesting stuff. So that's what I've been watching, Jacob. What have you been watching recently?
I've been watching nothing as, you know, enriching as Ipcress File or Cinema Paradiso or No Country for Old Men. I've been indulging two of my favorite Netflix shows that came back in new seasons recently. I'll start with Formula One, Drive and Survive. This is probably, honest to God, my favorite thing Netflix puts out these days. Each season is just, you know, I wouldn't even say like a recap of the previous season of Formula One. It is just an immaculately shot, beautifully constructed, incredibly well edited docuseries about the people and the teams that race Formula One cars. And it's as complex as Game of Thrones with as much backstabbing. The racing stuff is really exciting. I think it's shot at a higher frame rate, which I'm normally allergic to, but it really works for sports stuff, and it really works to sell the speed of the cars and the reality of, you know, working in the pits of all this. And even if you're not a racing person, if you like a good sports story, Formula One Drive to Survive is just absolutely addictive. I can't get enough of it. And Ben, have you watched any of this yet? I know I've talked about it before, so I'm curious if you've ever put your toe in it.
You have talked about it before. I only know it from your talking about it. Unfortunately, you tried to convince me to watch it in the past, and I just like, I have so many things to watch that it's just like really low on my list. But yeah, what season is this now? Because I remember you talking about this like years ago.
Yeah, it's just season 6 now.
Wow.
So let's put it this way, Ben. When I first started watching Formula One Drive to Survive, I had no interest in racing. Now I follow Formula One, and I'm trying to find out where I can stream it. And there actually is a Formula One track outside of Austin. I looked at ticket prices last week. So,
man, wow, okay.
Apparently, it's doing its job, which is to make dirty casuals like me interested in the sport of racing. So, something's happening there. Have you seen or heard of Physical 100? Have I talked about this before on the show?
I don't remember if you've talked about it. Somebody has definitely talked about it on this podcast.
Well, I'll be brief. It may have been me. Physical 100 is a South Korean Netflix-produced reality show, or 100 athletes, whether professional or amateur, come together and embark on these incredibly grueling physical challenges that are essentially production designed to the hilt. You know, it's not just, you know, something simple like who can lift the most weights. It will be like the aesthetic is totally Squid Game. Like, it's clearly a reality show that was greenlit after the success of Squid Game, and it has that sort of super sci-fi, vaguely dystopian production design going on, what makes this different though is that it's a relentlessly positive show. These are a bunch of athletes or people who come from professions where they need to have physical strength, and they're always cheering each other on, and they're proud of each other, and they're very excited to be competing with each other. When they're defeating each other in various one-on-one competitions, they're apologizing to each other. It's a real the tone is so strange because it looks like it should be this dark, miserable thing, but the tone is like a bunch of really supportive people really excited to see each other win. And
that's so wholesome.
Yeah, and the competition design is really, really cool. I guess a spoil one of them is that one of the challenges is a giant maze, like literally a maze full of twists and turns and dead ends. And at the center of the maze is a giant pile of sandbags, which weigh, between 10 and, 100 pounds each or whatever. And the idea is that there's two different teams going in at once. And these men and women, by the way, there's no discrimination between men and women. It's men, women, all ages. So you have people in their 40s and 50s, you have people in their 20s. You have men facing off against women. You have people who are professional athletes facing off against people who are just gym rats or car salesmen, but also just work out. So it's incredibly interesting because it's everybody against everybody. Mm-hmm. So in the middle of this maze are these sandbags, and scattered in various corners of the mazes are these two, are these scales. So the teams have to transport as many sandbags as they can within 15 minutes to the three scales to try to control the most scales. And they're allowed to lift as many, as few as they want to. They're allowed to focus on one scale over another. They're even allowed to block each other or steal each other's sandbags. Or you can tell it's really, there's like never any punching, but things like grappling, you know, or holds are allowed. So it's the idea is that the watching these teams, like one team ended up being like a lot of like judo people. They built a team around a lot of the judo and martial artists band together in one team. They're facing off against a team of a lot of the CrossFitters banded together. So you have judo versus CrossFitters trying to navigate this dark maze while lifting weights, while stopping each other, while trying to strategize over how to control two out of three of the scales. It ends up being just really intense and interesting and really funny, because at one point they asked one of the biggest guys is told to just block a path and not let anybody through so they can't add more weight to their scale. He's like holding back people who are much smaller than them. He's like desperately apologizing the whole time. It's really, really funny and also really exciting. So it's Physical 100. I think it's a blast. I mean, if you, as far as, you know, gonzo reality TV shows go, this is top tier. And I think it's really better than a lot of the American reality shows out there.
Awesome. Okay. So Physical 100 and Formula One Drive to Survive are both streaming on Netflix. And then you had a chance to see something in the theater, right?
Yeah, I saw Immaculate. I missed South by Southwest. And has somebody talked about this movie on the show yet? And you know how deep I need to go here.
I don't think so, no.
All right. Immaculate is a new horror film starring Sydney Sweeney. And it is a deeply blasphemous Catholic horror film. It goes places. The last half hour of Immaculate is a doozy. And I loved it. The last shot even, there's a very long one take last shot. I'll be talking about, early next year or late this year when we do our 50 moments of the year list, because I don't think there's going to be an ending that tops Immaculate, Ben. It's that kind of movie. But yeah, it's, there are scarier movies out there, but this one's gnarly. It is a gnarly movie, and it's out there to push buttons, and, even though I'm a pretty experienced horror watcher, there are moments in this movie where I was like, are they going to do that? Wait, are they doing that? They're doing that. A lot of people have, I think, made judgments on this movie based on the trailer, thinking it looks, you know, kind of like The Omen or Rosemary's Baby. And those are maybe like cousins of this film. It does some very different things. I mean, the basic premise is Sydney Sweeney plays a very young nun who moves to a convent in Italy and finds herself pregnant despite being a virgin. And sinister things are afoot as she goes through her 9 months of pregnancy and starts learning that what's going on surrounding her. And I'll leave it there, because I found the mystery to be incredibly satisfying. And when the reveal happens, I'm not gonna, you'll know it when you see it. I turned to my wife and she turned to me. We both in this middle of dark theater both had like stifle our cackles because we were so pleased with what the movie was doing. So that's Immaculate. It's in theaters now. It's not a huge hit. It's a neon release, so it's not like going to be a massive blockbuster. But if Immaculate's playing near you, go see it with an audience, because I think you'll hear some reactions.
Excellent. Okay, cool. And I know we have at least one article about Immaculate, specifically about that ending that Jacob was talking about, up at slashfilm.com. So I will try to link to that in the show notes as well. But yeah, you can find much more about everything that we mentioned at slashfilm.com. Slashfilm Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We really would appreciate that. That helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and hopefully we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.